I come from the Doctor's Television Show, medical television, the Dr. Phil Show, my executive producer also came over with me to do this work. But there are so many questions. And now that I understand how the vaccine lies are being told, how they're being built, and I get to go to these great speaking events everywhere where I meet cryptocurrency people and banking people and oil and gas and war people, and they start laying out how the fraud is taking place on the population, and I start thinking, oh my God, it's the same exact playbook. Well, there's somebody that has been doing this long before I have that is actually putting his boots into the spaces that are all the questions we have watching the news. China, Ukraine, what's happening in the Netherlands, what's happening with farming, what's happening with energy, what's happening with heating, what's happening with the world. This guy, Michael Yon, is on it. And if you don't know who he is, let me remind you, you've probably seen him in one of these shows.
Michael Yon.
Michael Yon.
Michael Yon, a Green Beret turned independent blogger.
A great example of how to do things real, uncut, raw.
You, more than anybody, have warned America about this.
A journalist and America's most experienced combat correspondent.
Michael Yon says the media are missing the real story there.
Michael was one of America's youngest Green Berets. That's not an easy thing to manage at 19 years old. He is America's most experienced combat correspondent, not necessarily a title for the faint of heart.
As with Iraq, there's not a lot of journalists actually on the ground in either of these places. It's very difficult to travel around without getting hurt or killed or kidnapped.
Did you see any men in black from the accusation from the question dress?
I was this close. You know, I spend a lot of time with soldiers in the wars, and the men in black that I saw seemed like more like special forces.
Within 24 hours, I was at the El Paso border with Mexico and watching the immediate influx of migrants after the inauguration.
I've been watching food and energy and migration patterns very intensely since January of 2020 when the pandemic started.
In every country that I go to, I want to know what the farmers think. I go straight to farmers. I want to know what people like truckers think, law enforcement, military, that sort of thing, the basic pulse of the countries that I go to.
When you get a big famine or a big pandemic or a big war, you'll get a lot of pop, human osmotic pressure that pushes people over borders and pulls people over borders. Panama is an invasion corridor to the United States, and there's huge numbers of people coming from about 150 countries through Asia and Africa and South America, and they come through Colombia, and then they head through that jungle called the Darien Gap.
I've been warning about this for 30 months. Since January of 2020, I've warned of global famine, and right now it's coming to pass.
Pandemic, famine, war, triangle of death, they always go together.
All right, it is my honor and pleasure to be starting out this brilliant New Year's with a discussion I've been wanting to have for some time with a guy whose boots have been on the ground, Michael Yon. Thank you so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
The opportunity to come here and speak. I was just watching your show. It's unbelievable.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I have such an amazing team. I know you know it takes a team. I know you know it's really about evidence, right? We can sit here and speculate, and there's so much that, you know, when we do the work we do in the medical space, I have scientists all around the world. We are literally inside CDC. I've got whistleblowers no one knows about that are feeding me information. But there's so much that's happening in the news that I haven't gotten to put my feet there. And that's what you've been doing. And so I think to start, I know you can cover so many different topics. Let me bridge on a topic we have covered that is something that I've been seeing some discussions that you're having out there, which is sort of food supply. And based on this fertilizer issue, you know, we saw how Sri Lanka basically is storming the capital. They're starving. They have farming problems. And we understand they were trying to turn them to organic, but that's not working out. And then the Netherlands are being denied, you know, they're saying nitrogen fertilizer, you can't use it. It's contaminating, you know, water supplies. And then here in America, we're told there's a nitrogen shortage because of the Ukraine. So there seems to be a lot wrapped around nitrogen food supply, but you're out there. So from your perspective, sort of take me through what is the most alarming part of the story that we're watching in just snippets on the news?
Well, it's, or if you see it at all on the news, actually.
Right.
And actually, we're in a war right now. And so at times as a war correspondent and previously as a soldier, often we don't have time for evidence and to analyze everything. You have to make intuitive leaps and jump ahead of it as best you can and work very hard to get things correct. And so I spend a lot of time out watching the migration flows as an example. This all feeds into the same thing, that human osmotic pressure, the push and the pull of migration, the hop, as I call it, right? We see our borders being overwhelmed right now. That's why I spend so much time down in Panama in the Darien Gap and down in Colombia, where I'll be back in a few days. I'm mentioning this because it goes into the fertilizers. One of the things that creates hop, human osmotic pressure, is war.
Human osmotic pressure,
right.
Hop. Okay,
the
right,
push
very good.
And the pull of migration, right? And so you can have a positive pressure from famine, a pandemic, war. And these things are conjoined. They're always enmeshed with each other, right? And so you'll find that the Darien Gap, this path between Colombia and Panama that feeds right up to the United States, I spend a lot of time, like I said, I'm going there in a few days again. Mm-hmm. I'm constantly out there with the Indians, Kuna and Imbara Indians. This is a pathway for Africa and Asia and South America to the United States. So normally the migration that we've been seeing is from like Honduras, Guatemala, that sort of thing, El Salvador, Mexico. But now the entire world is set up to be coming through the Darien Gap, right? For instance, when Mayorkas landed there, I got word that he was going there earlier this year. I got in position before he got there. I waited for him for about 3 days, and sure enough, he landed three Blackhawks right where I anticipated, and I filmed him landing. They're doubling the size of our camps to allow the migrants through. Now, back to the nitrogenous fertilizers.
I know I'm going to slow you down, but we're doing this on, this is being done on purpose.
There is a
purposeful migration that's not only just South America, but to get people pouring into South America to come up and into across our border.
Oh, clearly. In fact, Elon Musk, I think, brought it up last week on Twitter to a couple of senators and Jordan Peterson, who was joined me recently in Netherlands. I was on a show recently, and then he came over to spend a couple of days with me. Jordan told Elon to pay attention to what I'm saying about this invasion. This is intentional. We could go on for hours.
Okay.
Skip to the hop.
Okay.
The human osmotic pressure. We're clearly under food attack. We're clearly going to go into global famines. Now the question is, how are they going to unfold? For instance, let's talk about nitrogenous fertilizers like ammonia, urea, ammonium sulfate, ammonium nitrate, right? So they are created from a process called the Haber-Bosch process. The Haber-Bosch process. In the old days, we used to use guano for quite a while. That, you know, for instance, the Irish used guano, and we believe that's what caused, or scientists believe that's what caused their potato famine. Some fungus on the guano destroyed their lumper potatoes.
Okay.
Right? So as we go into the turn of the century, of course, chemistry in the 1800s was coming of age, and in 1905, a German chemist named Fritz Haber. He wrote a book on thermodynamics in which he described how he could take natural gas, strip off the hydrogen, combine it with the nitrogen that we're breathing right now, and make ammonia, right? Which he did in 1908. So he published that book on thermodynamics in 1905, 1908. He got his moment where he had a little ammonia come out, but it was very difficult. So in 1913, another German chemist, Karl Bosch, came out, and he was a chemist that could actually bring this into action.
Okay.
So he was working at BASF over in Ludwigshafen, Germany. I've been there twice in the last year, and to specifically looking into this. So in 1913, Karl Bosch took the Haber's process and made it industrialized. So by 1915, Ludwigshafen, Germany, BASF plant was producing nitrogenous fertilizers and exporting those. And they're also great for explosives, right?
Right.
So explosives and fertilizers.
Okay.
So, you know, of course, BASF likes to talk about fertilizer, but it was about explosives as well. So now, fast forward, another 4 billion people today are said to be alive or believed to be alive because of these nitrogenous fertilizers and other improvements, if you want to call them that, in agriculture.
Okay. Yep.
And so these BASF is the biggest chemical company in the world. Biggest chemical plant is at Ludwigshafen, 10 square kilometers. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
And so there's plants all over the world now. For instance, Yara from Norway that produce these nitrogenous fertilizers. And so we can see that the natural gas, for instance, is under attack. I've been warning people all year long, if BASF goes offline, that is Europe having a heart attack and dying in front of you at your feet.
Okay.
And so roughly 10 weeks ago or so, that's why when Jordan Peterson came to Netherlands and we spent a couple of days together,
yep.
I arranged a couple of dinners. One night was with a scientist, and the next night was with a former CEO of a Dutch chemical plant, which is like BASF. And I asked him to explain to Dr. Peterson exactly the things that he told me. For instance, Europe is not exporting any nitrogenous fertilizers now, which means Brazil is not getting it. They're not going to get it from Trinidad and Tobago. They're not going to get it from China. They're not going to get much from us. They're going to be in a world of hurt, as is India, Thailand. Thailand only creates about 8% of their nitrogenous fertilizers. They imported 5 million metric tons last year. I was with a prime minister of Thailand, former prime minister, a friend of mine, Abhisit, recently. I flew over there to talk with him about this. He says, Michael, you know, we export so much rice every year. And I was like, I get it, Mark. His nickname's Mark. But you create only 8% of your nitrogenous fertilizers. And when you're exporting rice, you're exporting nitrogen. Nitrogen sucks that nitrogen out, and it's gone. And your soil is very weak in nitrogen. That's why you import 92% of your fertilizers, right?
Wow.
And so what are we getting to with this? What we're getting to is, you saw what happened in Sri Lanka. We're looking at that on a global scale.
Yeah.
Right? Now, when Nord Stream 1, BASF was got their stock from Nord Stream 1, right? And so when I was
talking about natural gas, because this is a product that is derived from and worked through natural gas.
Yeah, you cannot make these fertilizers from electricity. You can have all the nuke plants in the world and solar and all these things. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
You need the hydrogen from the natural gas.
Okay. Right? Got it.
Haber-Bosch process, one of the most important chemical processes in all of humanity.
I got
right?
that, okay.
And so you have to have the natural gas. So when I was at BASF, I was specifically asking, where do you get your gas? Nord Stream 1, right?
Right.
We remember President Trump warning the Germans about that, and the Germans laughing. But for those of us who track this, I was like, you know, you're giving the Russians your throat, right?
Right.
And now, naturally, something happened to Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2. They were blown up. Who did that? Probably us. I mean, that's quite obvious. That was like cutting these arteries. Europe is going to die, right? Because BASF is now dead, right? They're moving operations over to China. Of the 29 plants in Europe that make the nitrogenous fertilizers, most of those are either closed or almost closed. So there's just not going to be enough fertilizer. So what's already created is mostly out there. There are other, you know, places that are creating nitrogenous fertilizers. We do, as an example. But there's just not enough.
Right.
And we see many of these other disruptions unfolding right now. So what's been obvious, I've been warning about this since January of 2020. I was in Hong Kong covering the fighting there for 7 months, and then they finally kicked me out. They should have kicked me out after about 7 minutes because, you know, let's just face it, I was part of the problem. You know? But they finally kicked me out
right when the
pandemic was unfolding. And I'd been watching that. In late 2019, I sensed something was off. And I was unclear, but, you know, there was signal-to-noise issues there. Mm-hmm. And then in January of 2020, Steve Bannon called me. He said, do you think that there's a pandemic unfolding? I'm like, I'm not sure, but I'm actually buying masks. And I was in Hong Kong, right?
Yeah.
But there's some signal there, right?
Yeah.
And then by February, it became clear. And back then, if you called it a pandemic, you would get kicked off of social media, right?
Right.
And so that was when I started telling people, stock up on food. Because there are certain things that always run together. Pandemic, famine, and war, and human osmotic pressure. If you get a big war, you will always get famine. You will always get pandemic. There is no exception. If you get a big famine, you will always get pandemic, and you'll always get war. These three run together. I was doing an interview a year or so ago, and a lady said, you talk about this like you made it up. And I said, well, I did, because this is what I study. And she goes, no, it's in the Bible. And, you know, the four horsemen. I was like, sorry about that. That's probably where I got it.
Right.
I forgot, because they knew it way back then. It's clearly in the Bible, the four horsemen. So people have known about this for at least 2,000 years. But for instance, famine. One of the things you always get with serious famine is epidemic typhus, right? Typhus that we mostly have wiped out through time, I think is going to make a comeback. So every day when I wake up and I'm doing my battle update briefing, my own private battle, I'm watching for typhus cases, right? And I'm talking about epidemic typhus that's lice-borne, right? I'm not talking about the scrub typhus, but I'm watching these things, right? Because they always go together, and there are signals that you can watch and detect. And the bottom line is, there's a lot of what I call SRD. There's no PhD program that I found on pandemicology, right?
Right.
And there's none on faminology, right? I can't find any experts on famine.
That are sort of like that are putting like the whole bigger picture.
There's no doctor of famine, right? And there's no doctor of pandemicology, right? And so there's a lot of virologists and epidemiologists and all this, but those are subcategories, right? Those are subsets of the skill sets that you need to understand what happens in a pandemic or a famine and how they entwine. Famine creates more famine, and famine creates pandemic. For instance, famine creates conditions. It's all about conditions, right? It's not about sparks. You'll often hear, I mean, every day you hear sort of an amateur question. I don't mean to say that in a diminutive way, but sort of an amateur question is, what will be the spark? It's not about sparks. It's about conditions, right? If you have a dry forest, any spark will do, and there's always sparks.
Right.
If you have I'm going to the jungle in Panama in a few days. If you have a firework factory explode down there, it doesn't matter. It's
right.
a rainforest.
Right, right.
It'll be a smoking crater, and there'll be no fire beyond a day or two, right?
Right.
And
the
so
spark doesn't matter. It's the condition.
It's all about conditions, right? And so famine creates conditions for pandemic. Pandemic creates conditions for famine. And they all create, both create conditions for war. And they both create, they all create these, the human osmotic pressure, the push and the pull of migration, right? And so that's why I study all of these things. And the magdaddy of them all is information warfare, right? That's the PhD level of warfare, is information warfare. I've written 3 books on it, actually. Unfortunately, they're only in Japanese because I've been trying to wake up the Japanese. They are being very heavily targeted by CCP information warfare and globalist warfare, you know, and the WEF, as they call it in Netherlands, the World Economic Forum. They're completely conjoined with China, with CCP specifically, right? They have, you know, of course, their Davos meeting will start in, what, about 10 more days or so?
Right.
And I have somebody going over there, actually. I would love to go, but I have to go to the jungle. But they also have annual meetings in China, right? So everybody...
So this WEF, because we talk a lot about Klaus Schwab, this insanity coming out, all of our, you know, so many of our leaders, they're bragging now that they've basically put in place cabinets, Canada, France, you know, Macron, all of these are just sort of disciples of WEF. But you're saying that there's a real connection between WEF and China too, which, you know, is in some ways would be obvious because they don't hide these things. These aren't hidden meetings. They're very sort of visible with what they're doing.
They have annual meetings in China.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can see Xi with Klaus Schwab.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it comes to somebody asked me recently, is the Dutch government influenced by the WEF, as they call it in the Netherlands? I said, no, they're not influenced. They're captured. That is a captured government. Mm-hmm. You know,
What are they captured by? Like, what is it? Financial interest? Does WEF? You know, I always think of like the World Bank, the IMF. Like, is it you're not going to get funds? To prosper if you don't do blah blah blah? Is that how this is working, or is it? Are there more details? I mean, how do they control a nation like the Netherlands?
You know, when you're trying to gain control over people, let's say for espionage purposes, there's something called mice, right? So there's money, ideology, coercion, for instance, videotapes, and ego, right? And this is how that they've, you know, gotten people around the world, is the mice, right? I mean, it's an old thing, it works, and everybody knows it intuitively, but that's what they call it in the spy world, mice, right? And so you'll see many people are just bought off. Some are coerced, others are ideologically driven, and others are just ego. They want to, you know, be out there on the forefront. Look at Trudeau. I mean, he looks a little ego-driven. Of course, he's there from his family, and he's also somewhat of not a highly intelligent man. He would be easy to dupe, right?
Right.
And so, but...
Well, and sort of like you also, because just to sort of take it back a second, Nord Stream pipeline. You said you believe it's pretty obvious that America blew that up. I know we've been told Russia did it or, you know, like to stop the supply. But sort of take me through that thought. Why America? And the thing, and sort of bring it around, I know to sort of focus this, here's what I keep asking myself, because I've watched this pandemic unfold. I've watched this vaccine that was so clearly a problem from the beginning. It was ridiculous. We knew it didn't stop transmission before any civilian got it outside of the trials. We knew it. It said it in the trials. How is everybody missing this? And then people, I keep arguing with people, like, this is all being done on purpose. They're reducing population. They're killing people. And I say things like, to do what? Be surrounded by people like me that didn't take it? Like, all they want is a world filled of Dell Bigtrees, Aaron Series, you know, Michael Yons, or, you know what I mean? That this is what you want the planet populate? It doesn't make sense to me. What also really doesn't make sense to me is how you could be raised in the United States of America. You know, let's, we're an international show, but we do carry ourselves with our own ego, right? The Americans have their own sense of we're the greatest nation in the world. How do people grow up in this nation, get into politics, and then get involved in, for instance, getting behind funding the, you know, the movement of people into South America to infiltrate our borders, to dilute our education systems, our hospital systems, our food systems, you name it? Why would they blow up a pipeline that will hurt and create starvation and famine around the world, which will only affect us? You know, we're all inter-trade partners now, so we're going to go down and then what? Be vulnerable to some greater globalist system? What kind of human being could be raised here that would be, do they know they're doing it, or are they just total useful idiots?
Most will be useful idiots. You know, the only cult that a person never sees is the cult that they're in, right? I've spent a lot of time studying cults after my special forces days. I realized how important that was to study things like this. And I infiltrated a cult actually in Sonoma, California.
Okay.
And tracked cannibals in India. That's sort of a whole different life. It was very interesting. Learned a great deal. And about cults and cult making, right? And you can see the World Economic Forum clearly is a cult, right? Mm-hmm. One of the indicators of that cult is just severe arrogance.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, it's over the top. But Biden and other members of our government specifically threatened Nord Stream 1 or Nord Stream 2. They threatened Nord Stream 2, which was pressurized but never flowing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there were the mysterious... Why would Russia blow up Nord Stream? They and Germany built it.
Right.
Russia would not... Russia, all Putin has to do is turn the valve and it's off, which he did.
Right.
In fact, the night that he did turn it off, I think, what was that, October 30th? I don't remember. I was up waiting. I was in maybe Netherlands or Germany. I was watching the website because there's a website you can watch the flows, right? And suddenly the flows went to zero. Putin said he would shut it off, which he can do. He can just make a phone call, shut it off.
Right, right.
If Putin were going to do that, why didn't he blow up Yamal? Yamal runs straight from Russia through Ukraine and Belarus, right? There's different legs of it. Why hasn't he turned off TurkStream, right? I mean, there's other pipelines that he could hit, right? He hasn't done it. It doesn't make... Now, let me preface this with war never has to make sense, right?
Okay.
So one of the things about war, if you're trying to make sense, you're not making sense. That said, let me immediately go against what I just said, is that it doesn't make sense for Putin to blow up Nord Stream 1 or 2.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it would be... not only counterintuitive, but crazy.
And however, I would guess, just sort of following up, however this war turns out in Ukraine as it goes, he wants to get back to commerce, and that's a huge commerce flow, and now you've set yourself back from being able to deliver your goods. It just wouldn't make sense in some ways.
They put billions of dollars or euros into building Nord Stream 1 and 2, right? I mean, they had built Nord Stream 2 because Nord Stream 1 wasn't quite enough, right? And so, and again, Trump had warned them, and they laughed. The Germans laughed at Trump, and you know, those of us watching this, mm-hmm. with a more, you know, let's say, experienced and watchful eye, we're very cautious. And now we see in Germany, they're cutting down millions of trees. I lived in Germany for 4 years. I lived in Europe for 6 years. Ich spreche Deutsch. I speak German, and in fact, I just did a television interview in Austria only in German. So I'm kind of dialed into what's normal and what's not in Germany, right?
Yeah.
And they're cutting down millions of trees because they don't have enough energy to get through the winter, right? They've set up heating stations so that people can stay warm. It's unbelievable. After that, I shot over to Ireland and talked with Mary Lou McDonald. She's the head of Sinn Féin, far left group, you know, pictures of Che everywhere. And I wanted to talk with her about food and energy. She'll probably be a future prime minister of, let me preface that with, usually when there's a famine, whoever's in charge is not in charge when it's over, right?
Right.
I cautioned Mary Lou about the possible food issues ahead, and all she wanted to talk about was equality and equity and these sorts of talking points and migration. And I'm like, Mary Lou, food. You know, and she said, what many of the Irish say, we export enough food for 45 million people. We have fewer than 8 million on the island. I'm like, hold on now. You got to calculate your, on the balance sheet here, we also have your inputs, right? Your energy imported, your fertilizers imported. You're not going to export that much food if you don't have it. And famine is endemic to Ireland, as it is to most islands. For instance, Japan has had probably 506 famines, maybe. Wow. Found this in an old book, in the last 1,500 years. So, I mean, a lot of these, like, for instance, Japan imports probably, it's hard to say, but maybe 80% of its food. Likewise with Hawaii, right? What's Puerto Rico going to do, right?
Right.
So as these food shortages, usually in the past when there's, except for, say, 1816, you know, there was the volcanic eruption in 1815, the Tambora near Indonesia, which caused global famine in 1816, 1817. But that was global due to the volcanic eruption. But you don't normally have a global famine. Usually there is actually enough food, it's just over there, right?
Right.
And sometimes your enemies interrupt it or something along those lines. For instance, the Hunger Winter in 1944-45 in Netherlands, that was caused by the Nazis. That was, and it only lasted about 6 months, then we D-Day and that sort of thing, and we finished that off. Or let's say 1932-33, the Holodomor in Ukraine, that was caused by Stalin, or Mao's Great Famine afterwards. You know, these were human-induced famines, right?
Right.
That's what we have going on now, right? It's clear, often you'll have a hybrid. For instance, the 1845 a pandemic of potatoes in Ireland, you know, the fungus, if it was a fungus that got their lump of potatoes, the Irish were rendered weakened by the potato blight.
Yeah.
And then the English, and not just the English, but mostly the English, you know, Ireland is surrounded by fish. It's an island, right?
Right.
Why weren't they fishing, right?
Right.
Because the English were stopping them. We had Americans trying to ship over food. The English were stopping it. Choctaw Indians sent over donations.
Right.
Even they were sending donations. I mean, and they didn't have a lot of money to be throwing around in 1845, right? And so so that was human-induced, and that was a land grab. That's what's happening in Netherlands right now. For instance, I was down in Mexico watching the invasion earlier in 2022, I'm sorry, and I saw the Dutch farmers were blocking the streets and starting fires. So I drove up to Austin and flew straight to Amsterdam and was out with the farmers in a few days. And I said, why are you blocking the streets? Why you got this fire here? And they started to tell me what's going on, right? And so I started going to their farms, and the farms are being taken away, much as Stalin did. You know, that was why they made the Holodomor. That's what we're trying to do now with the Amish and so many others, with bureaucratic land grabs. That's what the Canadians are doing. So it's a comprehensive war. It's not just this fake vaccines that are clearly poisonous. They're clearly part. Okay, I'm going to go out on my intuitive limb that those fake vaccines are part of biological warfare, right? I mean, this is. To me, it's actually quite clear.
Yeah.
But I know it's your show, and I don't want to.
No, show is about taking in opinions. We triangulate what's going on. So, what's your perspective on it? Since you were, you know,
my perspective is that we're in a comprehensive war, and this population reduction is underway.
Okay.
You know, one thing that evil habitually does is tell you what it's going to do. Right.
Okay.
Mein Kampf. Right. Wrote it down. Right. And did it. Executed. Right. So evil often will tell you exactly what they're going to do. They're crystal clear about shutting off the fertilizers. Right. Mm-hmm. They don't hide it. Go to the World Economic Forum website. They're building smart cities. For instance, I was in one recently in Netherlands. It's a trial smart city called Brainport City. They're trying to build. The farmers in Netherlands own about 62% of the land. Right. Mm-hmm. And the WEF, the World Economic Forum, wants to make a huge city called Tri-State City, right? And they call it Tri-State because it's mostly Netherlands, but also Belgium and Germany, right? So you can see the map. The World Economic Forum has the map, right? And so they need that farmland for starters. And you also want to get rid of the farmers because the farmers think for themselves. That's one thing that And I get along with farmers in every country I go to, whether it's Afghanistan out with Taliban farmers. They're all the same. They want to talk about the weather. They want to talk about the aphids. They want to talk about their family and the new water buffalo they just got or the new tractor, right?
Yeah.
They're easy to get along with. Like, I go out with these Indians in the Darien Gap in Panama. You look up the dangers of the Darien Gap. Those Indians murder migrants every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But I go out with them, and I treat them like farmers, and I get along fine, right? They're farmers.
Yeah.
What I'm getting to is when I saw farmers, for instance, in Netherlands blocking the streets, mm-hmm. farmers don't do that.
Right.
That's what Antifa does, right? That's what, you know, other clowns do that have been wound up, right? I flew over there and I asked them, why are you blocking these streets? I know you got a busy farm to run. You're a businessman, you're a businesswoman. And because they're stealing their land. Again, that's what Stalin did. You steal the land and then you replace them with your own farmers, which can never do the job that the real farmers could do. And now you've got control of the food supply, right? Control the food, control the people, right? And so the mostly fake pandemic, if you want to talk about real pandemics, yellow fever, smallpox, tuberculosis, which is coming over.
This has a death rate, as we've reported, of roughly 0.026%.
I mean,
it's barely perceptible.
It's like
the whole thing's imaginary. It's shocking. So when we talk about this famine, and you said that there's never been a worldwide famine, and you're saying there is famine coming our way, will America be affected? Or are we insulated from that? I mean, does it end up being, you know, is it going to be compartmentalized? Are we going to be one of those nations that say it's not here, but it's over there?
I think this time it will be here. And it has been here before, actually.
Okay.
There have been famines in the United or in America, let's say, before. I mean, even Jamestown in 1609, when my family landed there in 1610, they were starving, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was due to, they had a 7-year drought. And anyway, not to go into that, but bottom line is, we are not insulated against famine, right? Or, let's say we have been insulated when we had a reasonable government, right? When we had a responsible government that was actually looking out for America. We've got great waterways, we've got great railways and pipelines and tremendous resources, right? One of the things you'll find in the study of famine is that oftentimes, the places with the most food are hit the worst, weirdly. For instance, Henan Province in China, breadbasket of China, was where famine was some of the worst there. Or say, Ukraine. Ukraine itself is a breadbasket of the world,
right? Yeah.
That black soil and whatnot. Or some of the counties in Ireland, which were most severely affected, were some of the most highest produced. When I was in the Iraq War, Diyala Province is the breadbasket of, it's near Baghdad, right? The Shia were trying to induce a famine among the Sunni. I was actually on a mission. General Petraeus is the one that keyed me up to go on this mission. We sent a battalion of striker soldiers over to this giant warehouse on the outskirts of Baghdad because the Shia that had the food that was produced in Diyala province would not release it back to Diyala province to the Sunni. And so the commander who was there, he pointed to me and he said, "See that guy? He's got the camera. You're either going to be a hero for releasing this food tonight, or I'm going to arrest you, and you're going to be a criminal, and we're going to take you out of here, and we're going to take that food. One way or the other, you're either going to release the food, or we're going to physically take it right now." And he released it. You know, it was he couldn't really, resist that very much. So we took about, I think, 80 semi-trucks that night, something like
that. Wow.
But that was a human-induced, that was an attempted famine it wasn't allowed to occur because we were there with our military. And it was a Sunni-Shia thing, right? So that was a civil war type thing. And by the way, in Ireland in 1845 to 52, some people argue it was to 1850, irrelevant. But the Catholic and Protestant issues around that famine were tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even now, I was just up in Belfast recently. They have over 20 miles of wall still. I mean, that place looks like Israel. You know, it's like, it's got a proper wall, right? And more than 20 miles to keep Catholics separate from Protestants. But so what you'll have is in times of famine, your enemies, like for instance, the Protestants were trying to force conversions from from Catholicism at that time in exchange for food. You know, these sorts of
wow.
things. When people are weakened, then these sorts of things come out. But now, as we see the food shortages, like for instance now, last year I didn't see many people from Peru coming through Darien Gap or across Mexico into Texas. This year I see Peruvians every day. And so when I started asking, why are Peruvians coming? I mean, I like Peruvians.
I'm, yeah.
Not a loaded question, but why are you here? And it was food, because they're having food problems in Peru, right? And so if you go down to the border today, we could do it today. And we could find Peruvians today at Eagle Pass, right? And ask them, why are you here? And they'll say, well, the food's too expensive. We can't,
wow.
can't afford
it. You mentioned this term SRD, and then sort of went blazing. What does SRD mean?
SRD is something I've noticed in my studies of famine. Since there's no PhD study on this, I have to do it myself. And so autodidact this thing. And I've noticed that there's this SRD, substitution, reduction, and disruption, which always could be symptomatic or causal, right? Substitution is when the products that you normally like to get, say avocados, are not available,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you substitute and you get something else. Not a problem. I mean, you're not hungry.
Right.
But you keep substituting and then you substitute something else because now that's gone, right? So, we're always substituting because different seasons, you know, maybe
sure.
Apples aren't in season or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes it's quite obvious that we're substituting a lot more than we normally do. Now, that's symptomatic. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going into famine. But if you take it into context, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, right? It could be caused by other things.
Okay.
Now, the next is reduction. Like you'll see people I was just over in London recently, people talk about they're reducing their meals because they can't afford it, right?
Yeah.
So reduction can occur, substitution and reduction can occur because you just can't afford it.
We're hearing things like, you know, in England, deciding whether they're going to pay their oil bill or skip some meals. It's getting down to that in what we used to think of as first world nations. I mean, it is really shocking what we're watching the news. I mean, I'm saying to myself, have we just learned how to live on, forgotten how to live on this planet? I mean, I don't even understand how anyone is being reelected in England or Germany when you, like you said, there's no heating, there's no oil. I mean, now I got to choose between food and whether my house is, are we in the same century? You know, we all in the same century? Or do we just go back in time?
Ukraine flags were flying all over London when I was just there and all over Ireland, even as their prices in Germany as well, right? I'm like, listen, Germany, you're about to be very cold, right?
Yeah,
and it's only going to get worse as 2023 unfolds. Of course, this is complex, and so it's unpredictable exactly how it will unfold. But it's all about conditions, and the conditions are worsening, and this is man-made, right?
So SRD, we're at the R, so reduction, and then D.
Disruption. When it comes to this substitution and reduction, that if you go back to Weimar Germany, you know, the hyperinflation and that sort of thing, which also led to famine, right? Even down in Austria, right? And so so people were substituting because they couldn't afford it and reducing because they couldn't afford it, hyperinflation. Now, let's get to disruption. Now, when people are hungry and they can't afford things, good people then turn to crime. They're not really criminal. I mean, they're feeding their family. They're hungry. They're just going to do what they're going to do. One Russian doctor calls it, you know, wolf behavior. I mean, at some point, which happens very quickly, you know.
Survival.
Yeah. I mean, people are going
smart to people eat. Have self-protective mechanisms, too.
Right.
And when you're running out of food and someone just bashed in the window of a store and you see food there, you don't go, well, I'm a good citizen, therefore, and I'm a smart guy, therefore, I'm going to just let my family starve.
You're going to answer the call of the wild. I mean,
right.
You know, and so now you get into disruption, and disruption creates more disruption. For instance, as people rob stores or rob trains, then they stop flowing. And one of the things that they do is called gleaning. When I was with Jordan Peterson out with a farmer named Jordan in Netherlands, Jordan, you know how tall those Dutch are, drink a lot of milk. Jordan said, Michael, they're starting to glean down the streets now. They're growing onions, and gleaning is an old thing, glean with a G, not clean, but glean. And it's actually in the Bible again. Gleaning is when people go and collect the crops that aren't completely harvested, right? Like Jordan said, about 2 to 3% of the onions aren't collected because they fall off the truck or they just don't get them out of the ground or whatever. And so the people come and they glean, right?
Yeah.
So he said he's never seen gleaning in his life until the week before Jordan Peterson was with me there. And he said his parents and grandparents told him what gleaning was, that's why he knew what they were doing, right? And so
I actually heard the term when I was working, I think it was on Dr. Phil, it might have been the doctors, there's people in America in terms of those gleaners when they jump into garbage cans and get out like all the produce that's being thrown out of the grocery store, dumpster diving essentially, for produce and meats that's still good as far as they're concerned. They consider themselves gleaners. So it's the second time I've heard that term.
Yeah. I think you're going to hear it a lot more now. In fact, I looked on YouTube for any, there's that instructive videos now. Now, getting to the disruption aspects of gleaning. Now, normally gleaning, as it is, say, in the Bible, I looked it up because people had told me, and you're not to harvest the edges of your field so that passersby or very poor people can collect those parts, right? Mm. And so, and Jordan told me in the old days in Netherlands, they didn't do the corners, right? And the edges as well.
Okay.
And so for that reason, right? And so, but now one of the things that happens when food is very short is, first of all, the government start raiding farmers. They raid the warehouses. They go door to door, governments. In every case, in every book I've read on famine, which is 22 books now, right, on famine. I just finished another and started another. And another 60 on pandemic, right? So that's 82, right? So these things are almost the same, pandemic and famine, when you study them. But when it comes to the gleaning, you'll see that people will start robbing the farmers. And often it's the government. The government always does it. And then the farmers go bankrupt, right? They stop farming, right? And so now, in that second season, it gets worse because the farmers aren't farming. And the people aren't transporting the food because they don't want to get robbed, right? And so so this is where famine can create famine, right? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, usually within a few months of a profound famine, like a serious famine, you'll get famine fevers. One of those is typhus, always. Typhus always runs with famine. That's why they call it famine fever, that and relapsing fevers, right? Mm-hmm. And also they call typhus war fevers because it always goes with war. And typhus always goes with big, like these homeless. These in Southern California, you'll see small typhus cases popping up now. I see it in my alerts, right? I use Google Alerts to track typhus, right? So they call it hospital fever. They call it famine fever. They call it war fever, ship or naval fever, camp fever, because when you get groups of people together that are not washing like they normally wash, typhus breaks out. It's endemic right where we're at here in Texas, right? Wow. It's just that we keep it under control now because we know that lice spread epidemic typhus, and we have the antibiotics to treat it. But what are we going to do when China, we can't get those antibiotics from China, and there is an actual famine. You asked to your question earlier, will we have famine in the United States? Nobody knows the answer to that. But my guess at this point would be greater than 50% chance that some parts of the United States go into some sort of famine, like a real famine where people starve to death.
Wow. Right?
And this can be caused, again, that D in the SRD, disruption. When people start to, you know, go crazy and burn things down, of course, old knowledge was...
Well, and obviously when you're saying things like that, is bringing up images of what we saw happen in Portland. We are seeing crime rates like we haven't seen, I don't even know if in my lifetime. I mean, we're starting to hear, not since 1960-something, not since in these cities all across the country. And homeless populations, everyone's talking about Austin, just miles from here, giant tent cities, you know. And I remember I went to Haiti after the earthquake, and I'm thinking, we're starting to create these scenarios and see them in first world nations. And then I think about, you're saying war, like race, religion. It seems like every way they can separate us, we are. Whether, you know, now it's not just your color, that's an issue, but also your religion, and now your sexuality is got to be questioned, and where do you stand on this? And so that we're becoming more and more divided, in many ways vulnerable. Is this the goal, to take great nations like United States of America, the UK, Spain, France, you know, whatever, and break them apart into just where we're just singular individuals struggling to survive? Is this how they end up making us a global system, that we forget our borders, we don't care about our neighbors now, every individual's got their own issues they're having to deal with? Is this part of what's happening here?
Clearly. Highest level of warfare, information warfare. I see in your studio you've got the book from Matthias Desmond.
Yeah.
I was in his home recently, last year, in Belgium. And he had a very important book that I've been recommending to people for years called Rape of the Mind. It came out in 1954 by a Dutch psychologist, Mierlo, right? I highly suggest reading that book, Rape of the Mind. Read it.
Okay.
And it's very important, and it lays out these, of all the dozens and dozens of books I've read on information warfare and studied it around the world, I've gone across Asia to museums in Nanjing and Malaysia, Indonesia, all over the place. Mm-hmm. And studying museum warfare is what I call it. I study information warfare because that's the highest level of warfare. They're clearly trying to atomize us. If you read Rave of the Mind, you'll see that
atomize us. It's a great term to help understand. So, all right, they. When we say they are trying to atomize us, what does they mean to you? Because this term, I've been saying, we give a lot of power to the they, and I'm really not into being disempowered. Part of what the high wire is I want people to know how powerful they are. Together, we can do anything. They're trying to divide us. They're trying to make us argue with each other about every ridiculous part of our lives. You know, the things that we used to count on as just fundamental are now being blown apart. If we can get back to our power. But when we say they, what does that mean to you?
I've seen you say that before, and it's a beautiful and very important question, asking who is they, because we empower the they that we can't see.
Right.
Now, to get to the answer to this, it's obviously a multiplayer game.
Okay.
Right? So it's a jungle. Who runs the jungle? Well, you know,
right.
They mosquitoes or you know the fungus out there. But clearly CCP is a world-class information warrior, as are we, actually.
Yeah.
And the Russians have been doing information war against us since the 1920s, and they're quite good at it, as have many others. So there's many theys, actually, right? Now, which ones are the most important theys right now? Clearly, World Economic Forum are the ones that are trying to disassemble our borders, which we effectively don't have any borders now. You were in Haiti after the earthquake. There's Haitians right now in the Dry Tortugas. I just got a message this morning from a prosecutor in Florida telling me about the Haitians are landing in the Dry Tortugas, which is islands right off the Keys. Or beyond the Keys.
Okay.
It's a national park. We just closed it a few days ago because of this. So information war has empowered, you know, if you say, well, you know, we should have borders. Obviously, the World Economic Forum wants there to be no borders so that they can dissolve our unity, right? To atomize us in every way possible, whether it's around race or religion, which some of that is just natural anyway. You know, it wasn't like the World Economic Forum made the Protestants fight Catholics or the Sunni fight.
But governments fuel these things in order to try and
fuel it.
While you're fighting each other, you're not fighting us. And as we're robbing your banks, your farms, all that, just stay focused on each other. You know, someone once joked, I think it was about trickle-down economics for whoever's up, but I just remember the joke was, here's how this works, there's 12 cookies, you know, the big guy comes in, takes 11 and say, hey, he's trying to take that cookie from you, and you just get everybody fighting over what's left as you know, your governments or whoever run away and pillage the, you know, what we have.
You know, I learned so many lessons during my time in Special Forces when I was a very young soldier. When I was 19 years old, going through what we called the Q course, and then through later training, we learned the seven phases of a U.S.-sponsored unconventional war, right? And one of those phases, the first few phases, are just, for instance, the CIA going in and determining what natural fault lines can we exploit, like the Montagnards in Vietnam, right? Mm-hmm. You know, who fights who here? Who's who in the zoo?
Right.
And, you know, bring in the anthropologist and tell us where the wires go here, right? And then if the government itself decides to do something, finally they may call in Special Forces, Green Berets, to go in and say, go with the Montagnards, or go with the Kurds, or go with somebody, right? And go with the Hazara people in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. right? And so and our enemies do this as well. I mean, we learn this from others, right? So this has been done for you know, and
divide and conquer. That's right. Is it that simple? Is that the, you know, create division?
Divide and conquer. It's that simple, right? The Muslims call it fitna. Actually, fitna is a complex word, but the Muslims watching this will know exactly what I mean by fitna. And right now, what's being created is the most epic fitna in the world. They're trying to cause Sunni to fight Shia more now. We're seeing what's happening here, but I'm seeing what's happening in other places.
Yeah.
They're pouring on the gas, trying to get Sunni to fight Shia more, which there's always the fracture lines anyway, this tribe to fight that tribe. This isn't just the United States. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in Thailand, where I have an office trying to split Thailand into three different parts, the north and or the south, the northeast, and actually Bangkok, and maybe four parts of the southern northern part. And so there's reasons for this.
And we have politicians here, do you believe, in this country, the United States of America, that believe in this ideal of breaking us apart for a better world, breaking down our borders? Are they going to enough WEF meetings that they're like, I like this idea, I like the idea of doing, I mean, in this cult, what are they being sold? That here's my question, and then we'll try to wrap this up, because you're going to come back on. There's obviously so many things we could talk about. But in this cult, as you called it, the WEF cult, what are they selling them on? We had, just back a couple of years ago, we had a booming economy, right? We were all doing fantastic. We finally looked like under Trump, we, you know, even this playing field with China. I liked trade restrictions, which I've been asking for even when I was a Democrat. But I'm not, you know, saying Trump is great. I'm not a political show, but I'm saying we were lucrative, we were healthy, things were great, we were sort of ending wars. And now every single place I look, when you watch the news, it is like we have forgotten how to live on this planet. We have, our borders are gone. There are politicians, do you believe, in our government that truly believe and are working towards breaking us apart like this for some larger global agenda?
Oh, clearly. It's in the open. It's not hidden. It's back to the mice, right? For some people on the mice, it's money. For some, it's ideology. General Milley, I suspect for various reasons he's coerced, mm-hmm. and for others it's ego, right? And that ideology and the money is clearly it for a lot of people. On you know, there's people like Bill Gates, who is buying farmland all over the place. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has invested hundreds of millions of dollars into the picnic food distribution centers in Netherlands and other places. When I was in Netherlands, three of those facilities burned down. I went to one of them while it was still smoking. It's very interesting. So these food distribution centers are basically, you know, he's got the farmland. They're printing meat over there with printers, literally printers.
Right.
And I went to a restaurant that does this. I didn't eat it, but I ordered it and made video. And
they printed right there at the restaurant?
They didn't print it in front of us.
Okay.
Quite gross.
Right.
And I'm somebody that goes out and eats with the Indians. I was out with Imbara Indians in Panama last year. They're like, you are like Imbara, you know, because I'll eat anything they eat. And I'm like, you're like my grandparents, only more brown, you know.
Right.
And they're like, those guys. But I mean, I'll eat anything in the jungle they'll eat, you know. But but I'm not going to eat printed meat, right?
Right.
I'm not going to. These synthetics, obviously, are well, like the quote unquote vaccines. There's something more going on here. But anyway.
So the burn down. They're burning down these food. Were they natural fires, or do you think that they're being?
It's suspicious that three burned down.
Yeah.
So obviously, everybody's thinking the same thing. Somebody must have caused this. And I've been told that there may be some, well, I mean, it's pretty obvious. Three suddenly burned down. I mean, something's going on, right?
Yeah.
Actually, interestingly, on kind of a related but side topic, you'll see in famines, there's a lot of fires. Like if you read one book called Mao's Great Famine, thousands of fires. And difficult to explain, right? Mm-hmm. Some of the fires were caused or had known causes, like people working in a warehouse, the government warehouse, and there's only so much food they can steal on that moonless night. We get together, you know, it's our family. We steal as much as we can steal, and then we burn it down to hide our crime, right?
Right.
Or the government officials do the same thing, and they hide their crime by burning it down. Thus, the other 98% of the food got burned down with it, right?
Right.
It's interesting. You'll see a lot of fires and famines. I've just noticed this reoccur in these many famine books I continue to read.
What's your hope? Let's empower the people here. I mean, obviously, I know I do what I do because I believe there's a better world in our future. I believe we still have the possibility, and I do it for my kids. I am fighting for my kids. I certainly will not accept where I see the WEF taking our world. I do not think what I've watched over the last few years in this country to be the best years of America. There's some of the worst I've seen. Some of the most inexplicable corruption in government I've seen, whether it's controlling Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, people like you and scientists, everyone, censorship everywhere we turn, you know, using FBI, CIA to cover up stories. I mean, it's really bad. Now you got, you know, Bankman-Fried, you're watching financial interests that funded parties. Now, I mean, the whole thing just seems like so corrupt. And there, you know, clearly are these, whether it's useful idiots or not. What do we do to empower ourselves under these circumstances?
On a personal level, I've noticed both in war, I've been in quite a lot of war, actually. None of us have been in huge famines because there haven't been any huge famines
right.
in our life.
I wouldn't know what to do.
China, right?
Right.
So that's why I'm reading so many books on and preparing for it, right? But teaming up is very important. Establishing your network. Like, I know one veteran, a retired military guy in Texas, and he's like, I'm going to lead my community. We're going to make it through this. And he sounds like this Japanese guy named Osugu in 1783. He did the same thing. Mm-hmm. He saw famine coming. He got his community ready, and everybody made it through. But about 900,000 other people died in that famine. It's called the Tin May Famine, right? And then likewise in 1833, another guy named Kenjiro did the same thing in Japan. He saw it coming for various reasons, and he explained those the eggplants tasted in early summer tasted like they were fall eggplants. They tasted very good. He said, mm-hmm. This is strange. Why are the leaves falling off the trees in early summer? He thought that there would be no serious summer. So he started telling people to plant millet, right? And in the Tin May famine in the 1700s, Osugi got everybody to build fish ponds, right? And he was distributing a sort of survival manual in Japan, and it told people how to prepare and collect 73 different types of, I think it was 73, different types of rices, or not rices, but grasses from the forest and that sort of thing, how to prepare them. Don't eat just rice because that's not nutritious. You have to mix it with other things. Mm-hmm. Grow ginger in your hedges around your fish ponds. People that this one veteran I was going to tell you about, he went to his church and he just made a spreadsheet of everybody's skill sets, right? And like this one lady, she's near 80 and she's a widow, and she sees what's coming. She's very afraid. And he's like, don't be afraid. He's like, what are your skills? I mean, you have grandchildren. You have a lot of skills. You can't raise grandchildren without having, I mean, you ran a clinic and a restaurant and a psychological service for the family. And he said, and she's, you know, she knew how to can food, right? Mm. So that's, we need that, right?
Right.
So now what I need you to do is make a list of the pressure cookers that you need, the exact types, how many do you need, how many jars, the lids, the vinegar and the salt. You just make your list and be generous about it. Go heavy, and I will make it appear, right? And then you teach the children how to can. I don't want you to be the canner. I want you to be the commander of canning operations, right?
Yeah.
And so she's very happy. Now she has a job, right?
Right.
It's a very important job to teach young people how to can foods. So, I mean, you'll find, like in the 1700s with Osugi, everybody of the 900,000 people died reportedly in Japan during that famine, but nobody in his prefecture, right? Likewise with Kenjiro in the 1960s in Thailand, there was a protein shortage, and King Rama the Ninth, great man, unlike his son, but King Rama the Ninth, great man, he studied agriculture. I've been all over Thailand. You see his picture in villages everywhere where he's actually at that village, right? He's always out with the farmers checking plants, and he studied, you know, water and these sorts of things. But he saw a potential famine coming in the 1960s. So he assembled a team, and he didn't quite solve the problem. So he contacted his friend, Crown Prince Akihito in Japan. He said, hey, we got a protein problem here. What would Japanese do? And the Japanese and Thais are very close. And so Crown Prince Akihito said, make fish ponds, right? And so he sent over 50 Nile tilapia fish. And now apparently 40 of them died, according to the story. And now if you go across Thailand now, there's fish ponds everywhere.
Wow.
And so you'll go on the menus, and just almost every restaurant you go to in Thailand, it's in Thai language, it's called pranil, right? And this fish is everywhere. And you ask the Thai children, why do you have this? Oh, the Japanese gave it to us, right?
Wow.
Because and you never heard of the famine in the 1960s in Thailand because it never happened.
Wow.
Because he warned. So people that see it coming,
can prepare for it. And most famines don't last more than about 2 years.
However, okay.
There are a lot that last like 5 or 10, like the Irish famine that lasted arguably 5 to 7 years. But this one is clearly man-made. It's clearly systemic. It's clearly, like, for instance, when Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 were cut, that was cutting these arteries, right? Mm-hmm. So those nitrogenous fertilizers aren't going to suddenly appear now. Those plants are closed or closing, right? The smelters across Europe are closed or closing. Factories are closing. So Europe is deindustrializing. And there's no bottom to this. It's not like they're going to go back to 1940 and stop. There's no telling where it's going to stop. And we see similar with China right now. Something clearly wrong with China.
Yeah.
This morning when I woke up, the first thing I did was check their air quality index to see, you know, what kind of pollutions are coming out of China. They've still got a lot of air pollution coming out, so they must have a lot of factories open. But you can see, if you look at the shipping, there's just unbelievable numbers of ships parked off of China that aren't shipping. So, I mean, they're clearly China's economy is collapsing, and we are globalized.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, they can collapse and we're not going to, you know, if you've ever rock climbed before, back when I was loving to do that.
Yeah.
Top, if your protection isn't in right, you know, everybody.
That's right. I'm a rock climber too. I know exactly what you're saying. We all go down.
Feels, you know?
That's it. And so important. And so I guess, you know, as I sit here and I think there are people watching the show, some that are like, that is crazy. Like, I'm going to have to learn how to farm. I'm going to have to learn how to do this. Yet, I will also say we've had Joel Salatin on this show, a brilliant farmer that's got great books like how to, you know, micro farm and turn your yard into farm. We've had Food Forest here, and the homesteading space on YouTube is the fastest growing space there is. People that are turning their housing, their spaces, you know, into farms. So, you know,
I think
that's where we're at, right? It's getting to be a reality. And I feel like we have to, and here in America, man, we can really be complacent. Just look at Germany right now, totally screwed. Look at the UK. I mean, I have friends there that are like, we are freezing over here. This is crazy. Yeah. What's going on?
It is. That's what we need.
Yeah.
The people like that are telling people and informing people how to make their victory gardens.
Right? Yeah.
But notice our government hasn't warned anybody. I haven't
right.
even seen a state government say, hey, grow a garden.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you can grow all of your food, but if many, many millions of people grow gardens, that reduces the stress enormously,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the distribution is backyard table, right?
We are just... When you look at this, and I was saying on this vaccine issue, I'm saying maximum 5 years before we're microchip tracked, everything that comes along with like that spear, that's the tip of that is this vaccine program to get into tracking systems. Did you get it? Did you not? We sort of pushed that back. There was a worldwide pushback in many ways. Yes, a lot of people got the vaccine, but a lot of people woke up. When you look at, you're looking at a lot more different sort of diverse, you know, systems that are all being manipulated around us, borders collapsing. How much time do we have? I've been saying for much of this globalist movement, this isn't going to be my kids. I'm not leaving this to my kids. I'm going to see this in my lifetime. We're going to see the results of the decisions we make right now. How much time do you feel like we have? How much time do I have to prepare for famine? And where do you see, if there's light at the end of this tunnel, how soon do we have to get there for it to be available to us?
Well, the world will keep turning, and the sun will keep shining, and the tides will come and go, right? The bees will keep doing mm-hmm. their bee thing. In the 1840s, they call it the Hungry 40s, right? By 1848, you'll see there were about 50 revolutions started, roughly. So more than 4 dozen, right?
Mm-hmm.
There were physical revolutions. Some succeeded, many did not, right? But one of the things you'll find in famine is usually the government who's in place and pandemic. Usually the government, that's why I warned that Trump probably wouldn't get reelected. Mm-hmm. And I was just going off his, you know, historically.
Yeah.
And I was just like, well, I mean, you know, people like him. He's more popular now than when he got in office. But if you follow this pattern mm-hmm. historically, the guy in charge usually isn't when there's a pandemic, right? And so my guess based on historical readings is that we'll end up in kinetic war here as the situation is clearly worsening. But again, it doesn't mean everybody's going to die. It doesn't mean that at all, mm-hmm. right? Everybody listening to this, everybody watching this, all of our families have been through wars, a lot of wars. All of our families have been through pandemics, endless. and famines, all of our
we're still here.
We're here, you know, and now the people who tend to get through these are the ones who see it early and start to prepare your network, right? Because you're not going to get through as Rambo, right? It's all about networking. It's all about listening, you know, the farmer that you had come on teaching people how to do things, right?
Yeah.
And you have you clearly are building a network. That's vital. Sharing information, sharing, you know, I've got this, you've got that, you know, I know how to do a roof, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
We'll get through it.
Fantastic. Wow. As awesome as I had imagined, Michael, I love that you're out there. I love that you're in our network. We're going to lean on you more. I hope that you'll come back and join us and certainly report to us what you're finding out there. The media is shutting so much of this down. I want you to know that we have a growing audience. We're starting to bypass some of the media I worked for at CBS. We're here to bring the truth as we're finding, as we see it. So I hope you'll keep us informed of what you're discovering.
I hope you'll invite me on.
Absolutely.
Because I'll come on a moment's notice.
Okay. It's really a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.